Welcome to the Center of Everywhere podcast, where we explore stories of rural Minnesotans who are making a difference in their communities. Rural isn't in the middle of nowhere. It is in the center of everywhere.
And welcome to episode 11 of the Center of Everywhere podcast. I'm Marnie Werner, Vice President at the Center for Rural Policy and Development, and today Julie and I are talking about two topics that only come around every 10 years, the census and legislative redistricting. We'll look at why redistricting is so important but has been so troublesome in Minnesota history, the role of accurate census data, and how a salamander became a symbol of democracy in the U.S.
Hello, and welcome to the Center of Everywhere podcast. My name is Julie Tesh, and I'm the president and CEO of the Center for Rural Policy and Development. Today, we're going to be talking about something that is extremely important for all the citizens in America, but especially citizens in rural America, and that is the census. We have elections coming up here very shortly, and replying to the census plays a great deal into our election process and many other things. So today I have with us, we have Marnie Werner, our VP of Research and Operations, and who wrote a blog post this last week talking about why the count counts. So welcome, Marnie.
Thanks. Good to be on.
Thank you. What a timely topic. I know we've been hearing about the census for a while, and I think some people still do forget about it. But gosh, yeah, what a timely topic. What have you seen here the last couple of weeks?
Well, the whole census process has been, you know, peculiar, you know, because it is 2020, and 2020 is just the gift that keeps on giving. So, you know, what, why can't it get more weird? You know, the census comes up every 10 years. And so you kind of forget about it if you don't, you know, it's not a day-to-day thing that you think about all the time. And so when it shows up during the year, people are either, oh, we have to fill out that form. Or if you're a real data nerd like me, you're like, oh, exciting, I get to fill out a form, you know? And so it's, you know, it's usually not a big deal, except that it comes up once every 10 years, you know. But this year, of course, it was particularly strange because of our old friend COVID-19. And so what normally happens is they start sending out notices about, you know, the census is coming up and you'll be receiving your form soon. And then they want to know how many people were living in your household on April 1st, you know, as of April 1st. And so the forms go out about that time. Well, for one thing, this was going to be the first year where they did substantially the census online. So you receive a postcard with your special code that lets you access a census form online, and then you would fill out that form online. So that would be new and confusing for many people, especially, you know, people who don't have a lot of experience with doing things online. Under normal circumstances, that would be kind of new and unusual for people. But then you throw COVID into the mix, and it's not so much a problem for the people that are receiving their forms or trying to do things online, but for people at the Census Bureau, when your bureau has, you know, when you're shut down for several weeks or maybe a month or two, and you're trying to work from home and you're trying to wrangle all of this data coming in, you know, the Census Bureau just needed more time. So, you know, the deadline for capturing the data got extended from, I think it was originally July 1st, it got extended into either September 30th or October 31st. And then it finally just got ended on October 15th. And now there's a new argument going about, should the data have to be, you know, should the Census Bureau be done with analysis on December 31st as is normal, or should they get more months? And so the census, which has always been just a completely non-controversial, you know, service of the United States government has suddenly become a political football, which is very strange, especially for people like us who use census data a lot. The census data was always that go-to source of information that you could use and rely on to be fairly accurate, you know, relatively accurate, and kind of the last word on things. And now with the issues with being able to even process the data, you know, one of the concerns is that will data that was collected in 2020 always be not necessarily questionable, but give people a reason to make it questionable, if you know what I mean.
Oh, wow.
You know, when it's political.
Right.
Yeah, when things with the state of politics mm-hmm. as they are today, in future years, will people, you know, on one side or the other, be able to say, oh, but we can't count on that data because this happened in 2020, or, you know, so-and-so said that in 2020, you know, and so it's concerning because it will always be questionable, you know, because of the political baggage that will go with it. And so,
yeah. That is really too bad. I mean, you think of the census doesn't happen during a presidential year. It's not all the time.
And so not all the time, right?
Not all the time. It's a rare, I don't know, I guess originally maybe at the beginning of the year, I would say it was a rare opportunity, mm-hmm. you know, that the election and the census were the same year. But now that 2020 has progressed, I don't really know if it's an opportunity, but it is, it's there, I guess. But that's just too bad that the data is going to be questioned. So why do you think this has turned into a political football? I guess two questions. One, why political football? And two, why is the census so important to rural Minnesota?
Yeah, well, I'm reluctant to even get into the political football question because, you know, as a strictly nonpartisan organization, mm-hmm. anything I say could be construed one way or the other. But I think it has to do with counting citizens versus residents. And you would have to go back to the Constitution and say, and see what it says in the Constitution. And I'm sure many people have gone back to the Constitution and looked at it to see whether it's counting citizens or counting residents. And that in itself, that question has been turned into a not just a political football, a partisan, a strongly partisan football, possibly the way it's never been before. Now, I just got done reading the book Alexander Hamilton, and as I've been telling you, it's fascinating reading about, you know, the colonies after the Revolution. Of course, they're not colonies anymore, they're the, you know, states. And in the 1790s, the fledgling United States of America, and the political squabbling and the partisan fighting that started immediately, even though George Washington, one of the first things he warned about was partisan, you know, forming parties. But they couldn't help it. You know, it was between Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson, and the infighting and the political wrangling that amazingly the topics were very similar in the 1790s to what they are today. And it's so, you know, nothing is new under the sun. But anyways, now I got off track with the question. What were we talking about?
No, I think that's great. You know, you think about just going down this little rabbit hole a little bit. Yeah. You think of, you know, Alexander Hamilton, and then probably, well, they never would have thought that there would be a very, very successful musical named after them. So who knows in a couple 100 years, maybe there will be a musical about now, which I don't know if I really want to see that musical.
<I know. laughs>
About 2020, but hey, what are you gonna do? Yeah. Oh, crazy times. Let's talk about rural. And, you know, I mean, I know the census has turned political, unfortunately, mm-hmm. but the census is so important for rural residents, and not just with voting, you know, but I know we talk about funding, and can you explain to our listeners why the census data is so important to rural Minnesota?
Sure, because, you know, the census data is not just counting people, you know, counting heads. It's noting things like, what race or ethnic background are you? How old are you? You know, when's your birth date? What's your income? And, you know, some people think, oh, this is such intrusive information, but so much funding, you know, whether it's grants or whatnot, depends on knowing what that information is. You know, within a particular geography, what's the average income, or what's the median income? And that's important to know for things like grants for low income programs, for low income families, or grants for Head Start, you know, which is for low income, for you know, little children from low income families. And even just knowing things like income is always important, you know, because of the factors there with, you know, low income often correlates with access to healthcare, access to higher education, access to various services and programs that are, you know, easier to access if you're higher income, and things like that. Then there are issues with, you know, do race and ethnic background often also correlates with access to various things like healthcare and education and whatnot. And age, you know, is your county, you know, what's the percentage of the population in your county that's over 65? Because that factors into grants and things like Medicare, and even, you know, that combination of age and income and ethnic background can even factor into issues of like funding for infrastructure, you know, and things like that. So your wastewater treatment plant, at some stage, funding for that probably depends on census data to a certain extent. We use census data extensively in our work, and so that has been used and taken up by other organizations who are applying for grants for things, you know, in particular, the grants that started a few years ago for childcare funding, for extending childcare in Greater Minnesota in particular. DEED asked us to be the source of data for grant applicants, so that they could fill out the demographic data for their grant applications when they were applying for this. And that was all census data for the most part. So it's very important for things like that. But I'm sure now you probably want to segue into the biggest reason for census data, which is reapportionment.
Oh, gerrymandering, right?
Yes.
That great word that I, do you know where that word originated at all? I know we were discussing gerrymandering earlier.
Yeah. Oh, this is going into the, back into the dark ages of the 90s in my college education. It came about, I think, in the mid to late 1800s. When there was apportionment going on, and we should talk about apportionment and reapportionment. The census data, you know, it's very basic function when you look it up in the census, is to understand the population of how many people are living where, because every state is divided into congressional districts. In our Congress, we have the House of Representatives and the Senate. And every state has two senators, and every state has a number of districts based on the population. And that's why it's done that way. The House, you know, gives power to a state based on population. The Senate gives power to each state regardless of population. And that's very important when people talk about, oh, we should get rid of the Senate because, you know, that gives a little population state like North Dakota as much power as a big population state like California. Well, yeah, that's exactly right. And that's why the Senate was created, so that large population states couldn't, you know, overwhelm small population states. You know, there's like, I don't know how many million people, 40 million or more people that live in California and 5 million people in Minnesota. And the Senate gives Minnesota as much say in things as in California. Back in, you know, the 1790s, Virginia was the California of the day. It was one of the largest states. It may have been the largest state along with New York. And then you had little states like Delaware and Rhode Island. And, you know, and so that was why it was created that way, because they saw what happened. Mm-hmm. But anyway, the census was created to make sure, you can tell that I just love this stuff, so I can get it really.
I love that you love it.
I know. I can get so into the weeds on this. But the census was created because each congressional district needs, within a state, needs to contain the same number of people. Well, actually, no, I take that back. It should be each congressional district in the country. I would have to check on that. But either at the state level or at the national level, each district needs to have the same number of people in it. And that's how we ensure the very basic principle that our democracy is founded on, which is one person, one vote. And of course, in the 1790s, that only meant one white man, one vote. Today it means one person, right, one vote. And actually, I think in the 1790s, even you still had to be a landowner maybe to vote. I'm not sure, but I know there was argument over that because that's the way it was done in England. But today it does mean one person, one vote. And so that's why the census is crucial for that. Because people, of course, move over time, and you have more population growth in some areas, less population growth in other areas, population loss in other areas. And that's why you see, say, in the last census in 2010, I believe it was, Iowa lost a congressional district. Minnesota is always on the borderline. Mm-hmm. You know, are we going to lose a congressional district this time around? And that's, you know, undesirable because, you know, that's one less vote for your state and your state's interests in the House of Representatives. And so that's always, you know, a big concern because we have a set number of members of the House of Representatives. So as the population changes and grows, we don't add members to the House of Representatives. We just reapportion the number of people that should be within a district, and then we redraw the lines on those congressional districts to make sure the right number of people are in those districts. So the case you have is that in Minnesota, the metro area has been growing fast, the 7-county metro area, and then there are counties outside the 7 metro area that have been growing. And then you also have a few counties in greater Minnesota that have probably have lost population. And so you can see there is this ongoing shift of faster growth in the metro area, moderate growth in greater Minnesota, and then some population loss in some parts of greater Minnesota. And so inevitably, some of those districts in greater Minnesota, and I mean not just congressional districts at this point, but also state Senate and state House of Representatives, those districts will have changed in their numbers. I think after the 2010 census, the target population for each House district was 36,000 people. Well, I can guarantee now that there are districts in the Twin Cities now that are going to be much higher than that. And the target population for after this census is probably going to be around 42,000. So there are going to be districts in the Twin Cities that are going to be more than 42,000. There are going to be House districts in Greater Minnesota that are going to be less than 42,000 in population. And so to get those rural districts up to 42,000, those districts need to get bigger to take in enough people to get to 42,000. Districts in the Twin Cities metro are going to have to shrink to get down to 42,000. And so that means all of these borders have to be redrawn. And that's why the census and reporting to the census, you know, is so important, because rural areas need to get every person in there that they can, you know, because those, you know, that means as the districts get larger in Greater Minnesota, we have fewer representatives in Greater Minnesota, and the metro area has more. And, you know, after the 1990 census, we crossed a threshold where the 7-county metro area actually has more than half of the legislators in the House and Senate. And so, you know, we as Greater Minnesota loses representation, that needs to be more of a concern to Greater Minnesota. How do we manage that representation for Greater Minnesota so that we can get things done for Greater Minnesota?
Right. You know, and I think about our work with the Center for Rural Policy and Development, trying to look at policy from a rural perspective. It's becoming more and more important that we do that work, because they're not only for our rural legislators to utilize that data and that knowledge, but our metro legislators to have, you know, if they're not from a rural area, they need somewhere to get that accurate nonpartisan data. And, right. And that's us. And so I look at that as, again, trying to find silver linings, but it's an opportunity for us to work with metro legislators to say, now here's the information from rural, and rural is not the same as metro. Just like with healthcare, we talk about, you know, it's very different, mm-hmm. rural and urban healthcare. So I think that's something that we're going to have to continue to promote, that just because we do research on rural Minnesota doesn't mean that it's not valid.
It's important.
You know, that it's important. It's important. It's important for everyone. And, mm-hmm. and to know you represent your constituents, but you also represent the state. And, you know, I think our research does an excellent job of showing that representation in rural areas.
Yeah, it's showing that it's being able to put data and evidence behind the anecdotal stories, you know, and that's what the center was created for in the first place, is to put that data and evidence behind the stories to show that processes in rural areas just simply work differently than in metro areas. Not because one is rural and one is urban, but because one has sparser population and the other has denser population. And that creates different dynamics and different forces when it comes to supply and demand and economies of scale and just the factor of travel time and the expense in dollars and time that adds to everything for rural areas. And just being able to help policymakers and decision makers understand that these forces are at work, like laws of physics in some parts of the state, helps them understand that people aren't just complaining for the sake of complaining. These are very rural issues. I mean, Yeah, slip of the tongue. These are very real issues for rural areas. And so that's what we try to, you know, that's what we try to accomplish with our work. And that's why the census is so important. And that's why we get so excited about it, because Greater Minnesota is losing, you know, representatives. It will undoubtedly lose, you know, the 80 counties outside of the Twin Cities area will undoubtedly somewhere lose representatives in numbers. And so it's very important that we work to build alliances with metro legislators and help them understand in constructive ways that these issues are real and they can help.
No, I think that's great, and that's a great segue thinking about our state representation and thinking about, I think the blog post did a really good job of showing where that tilting of power is, mm-hmm. and thinking about committees, you know, in different committees. And for our listeners, if you go to our website at ruralmn.org and click on the blog tab, you'll be able to see the blog post here and see some of those charts and tables that Marnie has put together. But, you know, looking at, you know, our intern Jordan previously had done this study, looking at the chairs of key committees in the state mm-hmm. legislature, and were they more Greater Minnesota or were they more urban? And I thought it was really interesting. I mean, so for agriculture, just looking here, you know, over since the 50s, you know, 57 to 90 and then 91 to 2020, you know, for agriculture, Greater Minnesota obviously has like 90% of the time it's been a Greater Minnesota person chairing the Ag Committee, you know, but you look at education and it's the exact opposite almost. It's mainly Greater Minnesota, or it's mainly Twin Cities Metro, where the chairs have been from, you know, the Twin Cities metro area. And then, you know, taxes is pretty straight down the middle, and also transportation. So, you know, it's interesting. I wonder if you have any insights on that.
Well, yeah, I can give it a shot just from looking at the data. And I, you know, I should give a shout out to our interns extraordinaire, Jordan Barthel, who was with us in the spring, and Whitney Oakes, who's with us now, who did a good chunk of the research on this. Yeah, it's very interesting. We just picked four key committees to look at: agriculture, education, taxes, and transportation. Those are committees that are very big for both rural and the metro area, and where, to be honest, a lot of the rural-urban wrangling happens. And we looked at that. You know, if you look at it strictly from 1957 to today, the committee chairs and where they came from kind of shakes out to be fairly even, pretty 50-50, except of course in agriculture, where it's logical that the chairs the chairs would be overwhelmingly from a rural district. But when you break it down into two different year groups, and I broke it down into 1957, and I chose that date because that's when reapportionment started again, and we haven't even talked about that. That's one of those wonderful Minnesota quirks of Minnesota history. From 1957 to 1990, which was when the balance of the number of legislators started shifting over to Greater Minnesota. Education was pretty 50-50 on where the chairs were from. Taxes were 25% from the metro area and 75% from Greater Minnesota. And transportation was 12% from the metro area and 88% from Greater Minnesota. So that was, you know, 1957 to 1990. After 1990 to today, the chairs shifted in education to 83% from the Twin Cities Metro and 17% from Greater Minnesota. taxes was 47%. So it went from 26% to 47% from the metro. So that's about 50-50 with Greater Minnesota. And then transportation went from 12% from the metro to 53% from the metro. And that's important who the chair is, because the chair has a lot of say in that committee over which bills are actually heard. And in like the 50s and maybe into the 60s, I don't remember exactly when it changed, but legislative seats weren't partisan. You were a conservative or a, I don't know, liberal or progressive, but you weren't Republican or Democrat. And so you didn't have one party in power, so to speak. So one person could stay the chair of a committee for many years, you know, because you didn't have one party in the majority of the House or the Senate. And so that person, you know, it was just the legislature deciding who is going to be in the, you know, who's going to be the chair. And so you had long stretches where one person from Greater Minnesota was the chair of a committee for 10, 12 years, you know, for many sessions. Well, that changed when it became partisan, because then it started to be, well, if the Democrats are in the majority, then the Democrats will decide who's going to be the chair of that party. And if the Republicans are in the majority, it'll be a Republican chair of that party. Well, now as we see the Democratic Party concentrating more and more in the metro area and in urban population centers, we see that while there's a Democratic majority, more of the chairs are from, you know, as there's a Democratic majority, the chairs will be Democrats, which by default means they will be either from the metro area or from a population center like, say, Duluth. And you know, right now the Republicans are in the majority in the Senate, so the chairs are more likely to be from Greater Minnesota, because there are more senators from Greater Minnesota, because, you know, the Republicans have concentrated in the more rural districts of Greater Minnesota. And so that's why you see how the population shift even plays into who's in the majority. You know, 10 years ago, there were more Democrats in Greater Minnesota, you know, than there are now. And so this partisan shift of Democrats concentrating in urban areas, you know, and Republicans concentrating in rural areas has an impact even on how rural areas are represented. And I'm not sure if that makes sense, but that's what's
going on. Well, and I hate saying the rural-urban divide, but I think it speaks to the rural-urban divide, and not that we want there to be a divide, but that is where population is shifting to.
Right.
And we don't want it that way, but that is the way it is. And going back to what we said previously, you know, that's where our work comes in. You know, being able to find some common ground with metro legislators and metro decision makers.
Right.
You know, talking to our neighbors about where do our interests align? You know, where can we work on things together? And, you know, for us with CRPD and in rural, as residents of rural Minnesota, it doesn't matter if you're an R or a D or an I, you know, we're here, we care about rural. And so, but it's hard because the population is getting more segmented that way. So.
Yeah, and that's why it's
definitely a challenge.
Exactly. And that's why, you know, and this partisan shift, you know, by geography is why it's even more important that we be able to transcend partisan divides with reliable data, like census data, because I was talking about how knowing where low-income people are is so important, because so much funding, you know, is to help people in low-income areas. Well, yes, people are lower income on average in Greater Minnesota, but there are many districts in the very urban cores of Minneapolis and St. Paul that are also very low income. And so we do have that very much in common, the whole income issue. Income is a factor in if you have broadband, you know, so in Greater Minnesota, it's distance and income. In the urban core, it's the age of the infrastructure and income. And so we have that broadband issue in common. Healthcare, education, income all plays a factor into that. And so we do have a lot of issues in common with urban areas. They just look different on the surface. But when you can start digging in on the data, that makes, you know, that's where things start to show up and you start to say, look, we can work together on these things because it's for the benefit of all of us.
Right, exactly. Let's talk about the origin of the great word gerrymandering.
That's one of the great words of American politics. It's I think it was invented in maybe in the mid 1800s to late 1800s. And it was to do with this whole apportionment issue and redistricting issue, which is redistricting is when we redraw those boundaries or when the legislature tries to redraw those boundaries. And if you have people of political partisan persuasion who are not terribly, you know, ethical, they will say, oh, we have this district here, but I would like to get more people of this party, you know, of my party into this district. So let's just draw the border kind of out here to take in this group over here and get them in here. And so you started having districts, and you can even see this, not so much in Minnesota, but in like some of the eastern states, you can still see it today, where the district will be kind of long and snaky. And So when the political cartoonists of the day started seeing the maps of these districts, some smart aleck said, oh, that looks like a salamander. And they drew this cartoon of this district and drew, you know, a salamander over it. And then whoever it was that they were poking fun at, some political official, and the word Jerry was in his name. I don't remember if his name was Gerald or something like that, but Jerry was in his name. So in his honor, this cartoonist invented the word gerrymander. So it's Jerry and a salamander. And so
I had no clue. Yep.
And so he invented that term and it stuck ever since. And so Gerrymandering is the act of drawing a political district in such a way that is, you know, kind of like going all over the place for not a very, you know, logical reason, except for political advantage.
And oh my goodness.
Yes, and so that's the origin of the word gerrymandering. But we need to talk about Minnesota history. And it's...
Okay, I like Minnesota history.
It's interesting.
Are there salamanders involved in Minnesota history?
I'm sure there were at some point. And I'm sure, you know, one side has accused the other side of Jerry salamanders all, you know, at some point or another. But we have an interesting history in that reapportioning and redistricting simply didn't happen much in early Minnesota. And I think up until the early 1900s, they did do some reapportioning. And then from the early 1900s up to the mid 50s, no reapportionment was happening at all. And so the census would go by and nothing changed. And, you know,
why maybe, is that?
Well, the excuse may have been that in 1930, we were in the middle of the Great Depression. In 1920, we had just come out of World War I, and agriculture was in a massive, devastating depression at the time, so maybe they were too busy to redistrict then. 1940, we were on the cusp of World War II, so maybe we were just too busy to redistrict then. Then we get to 1950, and people are looking around and going, hey, you know, we haven't reapportioned for a while here. And, you know, after World War II, there was a great population movement nationwide, even where people were moving from the farms into the cities. And so there was a large influx, you know, that was the birth of the suburbs. So there was a large influx of people into the Twin Cities metro area. And so the growth there was very big, you know, like they hadn't seen before. And there was population, you know, if there was growth, it wasn't nearly as big, or there was population loss in the rural counties. And so some of the people in the metro area were saying, hey, look, this isn't fair. You know, we have House and Senate districts that are much larger in population than some of these rural districts. We need to reapportion. And so they started filing lawsuits, you know, in the state Supreme Court, or they made it up to the state Supreme Court saying, we need to reapportion. And there were certain powers that be in the legislature that said, no, we don't want to do that. And the suits won out. And so after the 1960 census, they had to start, you know, reapportioning again. And so everything got reapportioned, and there was a big, you know, shift in the number of districts into the metro area. And ever since then, the courts have had to be involved because, you know, the one party will come up with their plan, the other party will come up with their plan. And if there's, you know, who's ever in majority is, of course, is going to win. Or if they can't come to an agreement, you know, we've had bills that get passed and then they die on the governor's desk because, you know, the governor's of the opposite party. Or the governor signs it, but the minority party whose bill didn't get adopted sues, you know, and so there's been suits back and forth. And so basically every census since 1960, the courts have been involved and basically saying, fine, we'll come up with the redistricting, or they appoint a special panel that finally comes up with the final plan. You know, they basically take it out of the hands of the legislature. And so even though it's the legislature's task to do this, the court ends up making the final decision. And I don't know if that's how it works in other states, but that's how it works here. And so there's bound to be, you know, in 2 years, it'll probably be the same situation again. And what concerns me is that this will be 2020 data. And so it's always going to be called into question. And there will probably be nonstop arguing about it until we finally get to the 2030 census. And hopefully that will be uncontroversial and, you know,
oh my goodness. Down. So you're saying, one, there's most certainly will be a lawsuit about the new districts.
Can practically
get reapportionment, of course, it's guaranteed.
Yeah.
And number two, hopefully 2020 is just a fluke year and it's not a fluke decade. And we have to wait till 2030 for more census data. Oh my goodness.
So yeah, so sorry to break it down. You know, I mean, sorry to burst the happy bubble and bring people down.
Yeah, but
it's
the way it's the world way history of politics. Has been.
Yeah,
it is the world of politics, and unfortunately, it's turned into that. But you know, I just to recap, I think, you know, the census data is so important for rural areas because of those grants and because of the dollars that can flow to rural areas. And if we aren't accurately represented in the census data, we're not going to get funding.
Right.
And that's just so, I mean, that to me, outside of obviously having an accurate count for, you know, how many people live in America, but gosh, those dollars are important. Those are make or break dollars in so many communities. You know, talking about infrastructure, talking about food programs, talking about schools, it is important. And maybe we can end this podcast by giving Minnesota, give ourselves a pat on the back, because we always do, I shouldn't say always, but in the recent history, we have been a number one on the top of reporting back on the census.
Yep, we were number one again this year.
Yeah, number one again by a large margin, I believe. So, you know, kudos to Minnesota for getting that in. And I don't know why that Minnesota is so good.
Because we're all above average.
We're all above average.
And overachievers.
Yes, yes, yes. Overachievers, kind of rule followers.
Yep.
And I truly think, you know, having lived across the country, I really truly think that in Minnesota, we are more public policy engaged. We really are. You know, I think the general populace takes more interest in policy and what the outcomes are. So kudos
to Minnesota. I do think so. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, great. Marnie, thank you so much for this important topic and this important issue. Again, if you want to read the full blog post, you can go to our website at ruralmn.org. And you can also sign up for our newsletter on our website as well. We promise not to spam you. We send something out about once a month with all of our latest research, videos, blog posts, podcasts, things like that. So thank you so much, Marnie, and thank you to our listeners. We'll talk to you again soon.
You've been listening to the Center of Everywhere podcast, where we explore stories of rural Minnesotans who are making a difference in their communities. Rural isn't in the middle of nowhere. It is in the center of everywhere.